programme for the rest of the retreat. So, talk number five, the dimensions of going for refuge. So sometime in the 1980s, early 1980s I think, Banti gave an important lecture in Bombay. And the lecture was entitled simply Going for Refuge, and it was a booklet on the reading list, but nobody seemed to be able to get hold of it. But he refers to it on page 103 and 104 of the History of My Going for Refuge. In a way, it's a deceptively simple lecture, as some of Banti's talks and writings can be. You can sort of read them and think, oh yeah, oh, sounds all right. But there's, you know, you have to kind of spend a bit of time with them to realise that the implications are very substantial indeed. And in this lecture too, he spoke about the levels of going for refuge in a slightly different way from the way I talked about them yesterday. After referring to the accounts in the Pali texts of going for refuge as a profound spiritual experience. But he went further than that. He does a kind of close reading of the Pali text, and he noticed a number of things. Sometimes it would happen that when someone entered into a profound communication with the Buddha, they were so receptive that the Dharma went in very deeply indeed. So much so that, as the texts have it, the spotless eye of truth opened within them. In other words, the Dharma Chakshu, the eye of truth, the Dharma eye, the Dharma vision opened. This means that they saw the way things really are, directly, unsupported by any words or concepts. Sometimes the old Pali texts might tersely describe what they see as those things which have a beginning have an ending. Whatever arises passes away. In other words, they see directly, face to face, universal impermanence, anicca. And this vision of things would result in a number of things. They would enter the stream by breaking the fetters of self-view, fixed self-view, the fetter of doubt and indecision, and the fetter of dependence on habits and observances as ends in themselves. So seeing things as they are leads to the breaking of these fetters. Their insight would result in them going forth from home into homelessness. And certainly, their insight would result in them going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So their going for refuge would be a real going for refuge because it was arising from seeing things as they really are. So in many of the old Pali texts, these different dimensions are happening in this one experience, as it were. And going for refuge, then, is one of the ways in which a decisive, a crucial turning point in spiritual life is described. The turning point here in the context of these early texts being the transition from the mundane to the transcendental. As Buddhism developed over the centuries, it developed, of course, its own technical language, so to speak. So other ways began to emerge to describe this transition from mundane to transcendental, the most important probably being the arising of the bodhicitta, the arising of the will to enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So Sangharakshita has in his Bombay lecture, after sort of explaining all this, the following remarkable passage, and I'm going to read it to you. He quotes it in full in the History of My Going for Refuge. The bodhicitta, or the arising of the bodhicitta, represents, we may say, the more altruistic dimension of these four other experiences, or rather, all five of them, including the bodhicitta itself, represent the five different aspects of a single, basic, crucial, and unique spiritual experience. I'll just say that again: the five different all five of them, including the bodhicitta itself, represent the five different aspects of a single, basic, crucial, and unique spiritual experience. The going for refuge draws attention to the emotional and volitional aspect of this experience. The opening of the Dharma eye to the unconditioned depth of its cognitive content. Stream entry to the permanent and far-reaching nature of its effects. While going forth into homelessness draws attention to the extent of the reorganization which, regardless of whether or not one becomes a monk in the formal sense, the experience inevitably brings about in the pattern of one's daily life. As for the bodhicitta, it represents, as I have said, the altruistic or other regarding aspect of the experience. That's quite a passage. So when we go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha in the context of the Western Buddhist order, we will be approaching, we'll be realising all those different aspects of that single, basic, crucial and unique spiritual experience. So going for refuge in the context of our Sangha is not some elementary ceremonial act. It's the great shift from mundane to transcendental. It represents the great turning around in the base, in the deepest seat of consciousness. It represents a revolution in consciousness. And that's, of course, the way the Yogacara speak of describing that crucial spiritual experience. So in the Western Buddhist order, we take very seriously all of these areas, all of these dimensions of going for refuge. So there's going for refuge itself, which Sangharakshita says is the emotional and volitional aspect of this experience. And that's why it's the most important, because that's what we need to concentrate on, first of all. The emotional and volitional aspect. We need to make the move. We need to act. We need to engage ourselves. We need to commit ourselves to the spiritual life. It's very easy, for Buddhism just to be something that happens in the head. And also, another reason why going for refuge, we use that language more than any other, is because it's universal to all schools of Buddhism. They might not give it the same place that we do in our own Sangha, but all schools talk about the importance of going for refuge. So Sangharakshita sees it as a unifying act, and a way of drawing people together. So that's the going for refuge aspect itself. But we also have to pay attention to the opening of the Dharma eye, which Sangharakshita describes as drawing attention to the unconditioned depth of its cognitive content, which is one of his lines that would repay some meditation, the unconditioned depth of its cognitive content. People talk about insight. Well, are they actually developing the unconditioned depth of the cognitive content of going for refuge? So in other words, seeing deeply into the unconditioned. And you do that by meditating deeply on the conditioned. When you meditate on impermanence, you see into the signless. That's what that leads to. That's the unconditioned. That's an attempt to describe the unconditioned content of what you're really seeing when you meditate on impermanence, the signless. When you meditate on dukkha, are you entering into the wish list or the unbiased? And when you meditate on anatman, are you meditating into the empty, the emptiness? So those are sort of indicators of the unconditioned depth of spiritual insight. And then there's stream entry, which Sangharakshita describes as the permanent and far-reaching nature of the effects of this spiritual experience, permeating every part of one's being and bringing about permanent, irreversible spiritual attainment. And then going forth is describing the reorganization of one's being, whether or not one becomes a monk. If we are going for refuge, seriously going for refuge, effectively going for refuge, it will reorganize our life. The pattern of one's life will change. When we, to use another image that Sangharakshita has used, when we shift the refuges to the center of our life, our mandala the circle of our life, if you like, is reorganized, repatterned, recreated. So it will change the nature of our relationships with others. It will change the way we structure our life. I think it's very important to remember. It doesn't mean that you, I'm not saying that you, we're all going to go off and become monks, but it will change. It will have an effect on everything. I think it is very important to reflect on this. I remember somebody once coming to see me in India, who a Buddhist, who was interested in meditation. And he said, well, I want to meditate, but I don't want it to really sort of change my life. And I said, well, I can't teach you, because I can't guarantee that it won't do that. You know, it is going to start changing your life. I mean, for the better. Got an interesting conversation. So it's important to look at the going forth dimension of going for refuge. Going for refuge can be often obstructed by all sorts of things, negative habits, attachments, false views of one kind or another, or even just the very arrangements, you know, of our life. And, you know, it's been important to look at those things which are actually obstructing, you know, our commitment to the spiritual life, to the Dharma. And sometimes with a bit of effort, you can sort of change them around to free things up. Sometimes Buddhist texts urge us to cultivate the mood of nisarana. And nisarana means literally not going for refuge. In the context, meaning here, not going for refuge to samsara. And the connotations of a word like nisarana is disillusion. Disillusion with things. In the reading last night, there was an unfortunate translation of the word Nirveda as disgust. I don't know if you noticed it. I think it's very unfortunate. It's much more like disillusion. It's more like a sort of seeing through, you know, so that things drop away. You know, disgust is a not very good term. Sangharakshita describes it really, it's more a matter of, you know, you grow out of your toys, you know, it's, you just put them down. So we need to start seeing through the false refuges, that's going forth from them and actually turning away from them and turning towards the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. A good question to ask if you're sort of wondering about spiritual development. I think Sangharakshita once said, well, ask yourself, what have you given up? Since you've taken up the Dharma, what have you put down? You know, what have you gone forth from? That's quite a good indicator, very challenging reflection. You know, what have you actually given up? You know, what negative emotions have you put down? You know, what attachments have you put down? You know, what sort of addictions have you put down of one kind or another? It's a big topic, that. And you'll be pleased I'm not going to explore it this evening. I particularly want to concentrate on the arising of the bodhicitta dimension. And remember, this, he says that this draws out the altruistic, the other regarding dimension of going for refuge. Like all the other dimensions, this is a vast topic. I must stress that each of these aspects are huge areas of spiritual life. It's as if, you know, for Sangharakshita, going for refuge is a sort of great many-sided crystal. Huge crystal with all these sort of facets that you can go into. But it's all part of one great crystal. Or, you know, another way of looking at it, with what he's saying about going for refuge, it's a bit like Sudhana going into Varochana's tower, Varochana's stupa, and seeing all these possibilities within this tower, within this space. Anyway, let's look at the bodhicitta. So the fact that the arising of the bodhicitta is an aspect of going for refuge makes one thing very, very clear. It makes clear that going for refuge must include an altruistic dimension. If it doesn't, it's not actually going for refuge. And one of Sangharakshita's most crucial, most important insights is that there is no such thing as a self-centered spiritual life. There is no spiritual development without a movement towards selflessness, without a softening of separateness. If we're not becoming less selfish, we're not actually on the spiritual path. We're not really going for refuge. Spiritual life proper begins when we begin to feel less separate, and that's actually manifesting in deeds, in generosity, in kindness, in friendliness. There's no such thing as an enlightenment for oneself. There's no such thing as a personal enlightenment. This Mahayana idea of the arhat, you know, that you could have someone liberated for themselves, doesn't actually exist. It's a Mahayana fiction. There's no such thing as a selfish enlightenment. You know, it might have been people, you know, in the time of the emergence of the Mahayana who thought they were arhats, but that's another matter. In the Mahayana, we're sort of criticising them. The original arhats of the Pali texts, they're not selfish at all. They are like bodhisattvas. But Sangharakshita is very, very clear that there is no insight without altruism, without a movement towards other. In this sense, in a way, there is only the bodhisattva path. There is only enlightenment for self and others. There's no insight, no wisdom without love, without compassion, actually expressed in deeds, in action. This is really very important to get hold of. So when we go for refuge, we need also to begin training in altruism, in moving towards the arising of the bodhicitta and living the bodhisattva life. But in relation to this point, Bhante's made another unique, or a number of unique contributions. He said that the bodhicitta is far more likely to arise within a spiritual community. This is actually true of any spiritual experience, spiritual attainment. When you get that vital mutual responsiveness that we talked about when we talked about the Sangha, when you get individuals sparking one another off, their individual efforts are magnified, and you know, practicing together in a Sangha amplifies, magnifies, heightens our individual efforts, and something extra can arise. But Sangharakshita goes much further than that. He draws out fully an implication of something that the great Nagarjuna said regarding the bodhicitta. Nagarjuna wrote a short work on the bodhicitta called the Bodhicitta Vivarana, which Sangharakshita makes a lot of use of in his lecture on the awakening of the Bodhi heart. So yes, we know that the bodhicitta is the great compassionate heart, the great wisdom mind of compassion, the great urge to enlightenment for all beings. But Nagarjuna also says that this bodhicitta is not to be found in the five skandhas, in the senses and the sense fields. It's not to be found, in other words, in the individual conditioned being. The bodhicitta is a completely different dimension. It's a different order. So it's not found, not defined by the conditioned. It's of a different nature entirely. And that means that it's no one person's personal possession. The bodhicitta is not an individual possession or attainment. The image that Sangharakshita borrows from the Mahayana Sutras to describe this is that the bodhicitta is like the moon being reflected in different bodies of water. You know, the famous saying, there is only one bodhicitta, individuals partake in it. Shantideva describes the arising of the bodhicitta as being like a blind man finding a priceless jewel in a heap of filth. It's such a surprise. It's such a sort of shock. It's such an extraordinary thing, this bodhicitta. It's as if Shantideva has been so altruistic, so given over to serving the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, that he's completely forgotten himself. So forgotten, thinking in terms of sort of personal attainment or anything like that. He's forgotten himself so completely, so absorbed in spiritual life. So it's a great surprise when this great, wise, loving heart, this force, this energy of bodhicitta is discovered, arising within him. So I use that word serving serving the three jewels, serving the bodhicitta, serving sentient beings. That's the overwhelming flavour of the traditional Buddhist teaching of the bodhicitta and the bodhisattva ideal. The bodhisattva is someone, somebody aspiring to be a bodhisattva, is somebody who serves the Dharma, serves sentient beings. So the way we can open up to, we can explore this altruistic dimension, is through service. In particular, serving the order. Now, I don't mean by that waiting on order members. That would be rather embarrassing for everybody. Serving the order in the ideal sense. You know, we talk about the order, the Western Buddhist order, Trilokyabodha Mahasangha, which is the great Buddhist spiritual experience of the entire cosmos, which I think is a much better name for our order. And we think of it as, you know, the order members we know and, you know, order members spread across the world and all the rest of it. But, you know, there's that order, but there's another order, kind of related to that order, connected to it. And this comes out of Sangharakshita's own vision of the order. He's fully aware of the order on the ground, so to speak, with all its strengths and weaknesses. But he sees the order as well as something else. He sees the order as the bodhisattva. You know, he says, you know, one of his points is that you can't really be a bodhisattva, you know, on your own, as it were, saving all sentient beings. A bodhisattva is a community, really, that's pervaded by the bodhicitta. As it were, the bodhicitta just flows through that community, that widening community. So he has this sort of vision of the order, and he says, really, the symbol of the order is the 11-headed, 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara. So let's just remind ourselves of the myth of this extraordinarily weird figure. So the story is of this great yogi. You mustn't forget that Avalokiteshvara is a yogi. When you see depictions of Avalokiteshvara, he wears an antelope skin. This is his, you know, the antelope. Not that he's killed the antelope, he's probably found it or something like that. I don't know the myth of that. But it's definitely the symbol of the yogi, the siddha, the spiritual practitioner. He lives on Mount Potala in the forest, meditating. There's all sorts of myths about Avalokiteshvara. I just mentioned one of them, which is actually quite important. This is sort of unscripted, but it's very, very important. This Avalokiteshvara is frequently known in the old Indian texts as Nilakantha. Nilakantha, which means blue throat. Blue throat. And there's an extraordinary mythology here. The mythology is like this, that the gods, the Vedic gods, you know, what we might call the Hindu gods, decided that they were going to churn the ocean of milk. So they got a great vajra and they churned this great ocean of milk, just to, I suppose, see what would happen. I don't quite know what the background it was. See an ocean of milk and you churn it. And so there they did, they're churning away. And up comes all sorts of wonderful things, the wish-fulfilling tree, wish-fulfilling cow, you know, the, you know, pot full of treasure, Lakshmi, the goddess of luck and wealth, pops up. And they're so pleased, all these wonderful things, which of course they can all have, and the wish-fulfilling jewel, and all this great stuff. Presumably they're going to use it in their battles against the Asuras, against the Titans. And then at the end, there comes up something, a pot. The pot with the poison that will destroy the entire world. Nobody wants that pot. Nobody's going to touch that pot. Avalokiteshvara, the compassionate ascetic, the great yogi of compassion, drinks the poison and completely transforms it. But it sort of burns and bruises his throat, leaving it blue. So he's Nilakantha, and it just shows what he's taken on. Sangharakshita has sort of noted this particular story. He once said that starting a new Buddhist movement, you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. It's a very difficult thing to do because you have to take a lot of poison, he said. But, you know, you've just got to drink it and transform it like Nilakantha, or like the peacock feeding on poisonous snakes and turning it into those beautiful feathers. So, sometimes we have to do that, even if we haven't started a new Buddhist movement. Sometimes, you know, we're in situations where there's a lot of negativity, and, you know, reacting is just going to make things worse. We've got to take the poison and transform it, and you do that through a combination of compassion, yes, but also deep spiritual practice, meditative practice. So that's one myth of Avalokiteshvara. But this other myth is, yes, he's a yogi, and he makes a great vow in front of his teacher, the great Buddha Amitabha. And the vow is, if, you know, it's a great vow of wanting to gain enlightenment for all beings, heal all their suffering and so on. And if just for a second, even the fraction of a second, I think of my own welfare, may my body completely split, may my head shatter into thousands of pieces and so on. So the story goes that he worked and worked and worked to alleviate the suffering of others. And then he had a look round and realised that he'd achieved very little. You know, that he'd hardly scratched the surface. And just for a moment he thought of his own welfare. He's of just giving up and entering some sort of dhyanic realm or something like that. And then the vow kicked in very powerfully and he split into, you know, his body just shattered into thousands of pieces, his head split. And of course he's in terrible pain. But then Amitabha, his guru, his teacher, the Buddha, came to him and said, very interesting phrase, all things arise in dependence upon conditions. In a way, it's a tremendous failure that's being described. But because of also the strength of the vow, something else can happen, something greater can happen. So Amitabha heals Avalokiteshvara and recreates this being. So out of his shattered, broken body, he creates 1,000 arms, sometimes they say 100,000, 1,000,000 arms and hands, each with a wisdom eye, each holding a particular implement. And he heals the broken head into 11 heads, or 10 heads that can look out on the 10 directions, and even placed a version of his own head on top of that, Amitabha's head. So this figure can look in all directions and reach out and touch every single living being. It's an extraordinarily, very strange image indeed. But there it is. And Sangharakshita sees that as a sort of, yes, a symbol of the order. But we'll just to dwell on the image a bit more before I go to that. No, I won't. I'll say what I'm going to say. Yes, so each hand reaching out with an implement. So Sangharakshita sees that as every order member being a hand. And every hand holds something unique or is making a particular, you know, mudra, a gesture. All the gestures are reaching out to befriend. So every order member is unique, individual, particular. But they're all connected to the whole, to the whole body, as all the hands of Avalokiteshvara are. And at the centre, Avalokiteshvara's two central hands are holding the wish-granting gem, which is said to embody the bodhicitta itself, with great reverence and care. And on his crown is Amitabha. He's going for refuge. He's still looking up to his spiritual father, Amitabha. It's interesting this, because sometimes the Tibetans say that there is a tradition, I don't know how they work all this out, that Avalokiteshvara has actually surpassed Amitabha spiritually. How they know, I don't know. But Avalokiteshvara still reveres Amitabha, because he wouldn't be where he is without Amitabha's blessing and teaching, without his refuge, which is quite an interesting reflection. So anyway, that's the symbol of our order. I think we probably don't dwell enough on this symbol and image within our order. That's, if you like, the myth, you know, of the order. There's another way you can look at the order, that we're actually trying to invoke something. You can think of something we're rising up to try and be like that with all our fumblings and mistakes and all the rest of it. But there's another sense in which it's sort of perhaps emerging, bringing something into the world, bringing this great bodhicitta, you know, into the world, pervading our order. And look at the faith that Sangharakshita has in his order members. Look at the confidence that we could be, all of us, a hand of Avalokiteshvara. And that means his confidence in people who want to come into the order. It's a tremendous expression of faith and confidence and confidence in our spiritual potential. I find that incredibly, you know, moving that he's had that kind of vision. So let's look at serving. You know, serving the order means serving this, serving the bodhicitta, serving Avalokiteshvara. And we can look at that. We can sort of bring that down to perhaps practicalities. Subhuti, in one of his talks, talks about three main duties of an order member. Very, very simple. First, and they're all important. It's not that one is more important than the other. They're all central. First, you make sure you are going for refuge. You know, you are doing your individual spiritual practice. You're following that path of practice. You're going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. You know, you're holding the jewel in your hand and you're looking up to the Buddha and you're working on transforming yourself, taking responsibility for your spiritual life. First great duty. Second great duty, you're committed, absolutely committed to being in harmony with all other order members, which means seeing, relating always to their going for refuge, the going for refuge in them, to the best in them. You're working on deepening that sense of heart of harmony. You're practicing that vital mutual responsiveness. The jewel that you hold is flashing in relation to the jewels that other order members hold. And thirdly, and just as important, you're helping others to go for refuge. You're helping others, in other words, to make that great step that you and others have made. You're seeing the potential of all others around you. You're seeing the jewel in them and you want to, you know, bring it forth and put a hand out to them so that they have, you know, a viable spiritual community and a viable spiritual life. After ordination, this is the path. Obviously, you train in it. You're doing it to some extent before ordination. But this is the training. This is the practice after ordination. These three great areas and the invocation, if you like, of Avalokiteshvara. Now, lots and lots could be said about this, but I want to talk about a particular set of teachings I think we need to practice. And these are the Sangraha Vastus, or the means of unification. This is a Mahayana teaching, although it also comes, it's mentioned in the Pali texts. So this can be described as the way in which a bodhisattva gathers a community in order to help in his work of building, of creating the Buddha field. So it's the way a bodhisattva creates a sangha in order to create an environment which is conducive for the development, the spiritual development, well, of as many people as possible, in principle, the whole world. So as a community, if we think of ourselves as a bodhisattva, this is real order practice, creating a sangha, bringing people together so that they have the best conditions in which to practice the Dharma. So it's these four Sangraha Vastus are a way of describing how we can create Sangha. And it's especially important if we're involved in starting, you know, a Buddhist group somewhere, you know, maybe in our local town, in our house, in our home, or whether we're involved in a centre on whatever level, or we're just starting a centre, whether we're maintaining a centre, developing a centre. These Sangraha Vastus are incredibly important, and they describe the health of a spiritual community that's reaching out to others. So the first of these Sangraha Vastus is dana, generosity, an old favourite. But in this context, generosity has a very particular meaning. Generosity arises from your delight in the spiritual potential of others. You see that others have spiritual potential. It's something emerging in you, and you can see it emerging in others. Maybe it's, you know, you've got more of an eye for it because you've been doing it a bit longer. And you respond, and you respond by giving. Giving of yourself. You can give your time, you can give your energy, you can give your interest. What a wonderful thing it is to be in receipt of somebody's interest. You know, and this, when I look back at my spiritual friends in the order, I feel so fortunate that so many people showed interest in me and really encouraged my best efforts. You can give money, you can give food, you can give presents. Giving presents is absolutely wonderful. Sangharakshita defined this when he was talking about this Sangharavastu, as the spiritual community should be characterized by the constant exchange of presents. The constant exchange of presents, just this free-flowing, generous exchange. You even create environments like centers and meditation classes and so on, so that people can enjoy, that support their spiritual growth. And it's not just about putting on classes and things like that. It's very interesting in some of the Bodhisattva manuals. One of the things that it says a Bodhisattva provides is festivity. Very interesting they mention that. Festivity. Festivals. Ways in which people can come together in a skillful way, whether it be the celebration of a Buddhist festival. Buddhist festivals are so incredibly important. You know, people sometimes, you know, it's sort of breaking up the routine to have a festival. It's not. That's the whole point. The whole point is to completely blow the routine out of the water and do something that's just completely useless. You know, to celebrate the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Go on processions. Dress up in colourful clothes. So on and so forth. Enjoy it. But also other things. You know, I know at some centres people get together for walks in the country. They put up a list on the notice board and say, let's all go for a walk in the countryside. And off everybody goes and they take their packed lunch. And arts activities. There's a centre I know where before their Sangha night, which is a really important class, they have what they call the baked potato club. They put a load of potatoes in the oven. The centre. People bring lots of food. Everybody eats together. And then they do the class. I mean, it's fantastic. I mean, you're all eating. People coming from work, college, whatever it is, eating together. It's a wonderful thing, eating together. So you're already coming together, sharing, you know, the bounty of the land. And then you go into, you know, concentrating on the Dharma. It's absolutely magic. You know, helping each other, looking out for one another. There's all sorts of ways in which centres do this. But it needs to be, you know, I think, strengthened. And we do this out of delight, out of the overflowing of our going for refuge to the Three Jewels. You know, if we're practising seriously, that there should be an overflow. You know, we should actually be becoming wealthy. You know, if we're not becoming sort of internally wealthy and starting to overflow in bounty for others, there's something not happening. There's something not happening. You know, it might be that you're actually thinking too psychologically of spiritual life. It's too interned. You know, but if you feel impoverished, there's something not happening. There should be this great sense of inner wealth, which is manifesting in generosity. And you're doing it to create and strengthen the Sangha. You know, and what I mean by that is not sort of, you know, sort of, you know, having a sort of slick organisation. Yes, run things well. But you're doing it because you want people to come together on the basis of the Dharma. You want people to come together as friends, you know, more and more people. And, you know, Sangharakshita has said, you know, again, usually in response to when people are asking questions about insight, how do you get it, who's got it, how can you tell who's got it, he'll often go to things like, he said once, he said, Well, you know, many people come to me and they say how much they've benefited from being involved in the FWBO, and the teaching is very, you know, clear and good and so on. But what really impressed them more than anything else was the friendliness between the centre team or the retreat team. They're just seeing the way people interacted, the way they enjoyed each other, the way they harmonised with each other. They said that was it, seeing people doing that. They wanted, it was very attractive. It magnetises, it attracts when you have that quality going on between people. That's the way the teaching manifests in that harmonious sangha. So it's incredibly important. You know, our centres are not and should never be like a well-run evening institute. You know, they should never, ever be like that. I'd prefer a completely sort of shambolic, you know, centre all over the place that's characterised by great warmth and heart and love and generosity, rather than something that's super slick, but nobody's connecting. You know, and even if the teaching is, you know, absolute sort of the best, you know, flip charts and all the rest of it, I mean, it's all rubbish unless, you know, there is this sort of warmth and love and generosity manifesting and drawing people together. And very important, order members, you know, should never be professionals. You know, you never be a guru. Absolutely out. And professional meditation and Dharma teacher. Absolutely out. That is absolutely what you're not. You're a creator of sangha, of spiritual community. You're a Dharma friend more than anything else. It's in that environment that the Dharma really gets transmitted. That's the solution. That's the atmosphere when you get a real transmission of Dharma. And then the Dharma actually flourishes, because it's flourishing in people. This is the Buddha's great point in his teaching on building the Buddha land. It's built with living beings. You know, it's not built with sort of ideas. It's built with living beings. And it's fantastic. You know, Dharma creates Dharma. You know, when you're generous and when people are generous, people respond. You know, I know a centre which run they're absolutely militant about Dharma economy. You know, you don't charge for any Dharma classes, and they're completely, really, really down the line about it. And their argument is that what you manifest is generosity, and people will respond with generosity, and they'll feel that the centre is theirs. And it's happening. You can see it in that centre very vividly. I mean, a very telling example for me was in this particular place. I won't mention the centre, its name. There was a weekend retreat we did, and they've been losing money on their weekend retreats because they go and hire a place, and they've been losing money. And they were talking about maybe I think they thought about, well, maybe we should charge or something like that, or they had a little suggested charge. And then they said, no, we're going to make it, you know, I don't know if they said sod it or something like that, but no, complete Dharma. We don't care if we lose the lot. You know, it's going to be complete Dharma economy. There's not going to even be a suggested charge or anything like that. Complete Dharma for the weekend retreat. And they have to hire a place, buy food, all that sort of thing. I'm incredibly bold and radical. And I was on that weekend retreat. And what I saw was all the members and mitras absolutely giving themselves. You know, all the members were not just giving talks and talking to people and leading groups. They were cooking, cleaning. You know, they're absolutely right in there, you know, involved. It was fantastic to see. And then there was this sort of, right, there's no charge for this weekend. Somebody got up and made a very good Dharma appeal. And I was actually put on the duty of collecting money. And people were coming up to me. It was one bloke, you know, who's originally from South London. He'd already given, like, loads of money for this weekend. He comes up with 50 quid and says, here, I'll go and get a drink. You know, and they were all coming, the people were piling in with money. And I mean, one of the other order members was watching this and started to get really worried. He said, oh, you know, I'm really worried that people are giving too much, you know, and they might be impoverishing themselves. And, you know, they weren't, of course. But it was incredible to see. So it was, you know, Dana inspires Dana. You know, it really does when it's done with joy and heart. So, big point here. A very important part of training for ordination is to get involved in your centre. Get involved in this in your centre. You know, support classes. Befriend people coming to your classes. Start a group if you're out on your own. Obviously, discuss that with order members. You know, get involved. Serve. You know, if you don't want to, well, why? What's happening? You know, what? Why is that? Why don't you want to be involved in, you know, that sort of flow of the Dharma? So, big part of your order training to look at that whole area. Secondly, loving speech, priya vadita, loving, affectionate speech. Priya is such a lovely word in Sanskrit. It's this very strong love and affection. You know, you know, it can also mean that somebody's very dear to you. Very friendly speech. You know, but you're trying to do that with everybody. It's communication in particular that encourages others, rouses others, inspires them, clarifies the Dharma for them, even, you know, at the right time, in the right way, will show what they're doing that's in the way of unfolding their spiritual potential, and not sentimentality. We're not talking about sentimentality. We're talking about a vigorous expression of your delight in others as growing beings. And it's an expression of your awareness of the Dharma, awareness of the spiritual potential in others. You know, and there's here things like rejoicing in merit. What a fantastic practice that is. You know, just really genuinely seeing the quality of another and actually telling them what it is naturally, without any sort of self-interest and very clearly, without any sentimentality. Delighting in that quality. I mean, when you're on the end of really good rejoicing in merit, it's humbling because, well, you have to take yourself seriously, don't you, when somebody does that. So it can be quite challenging, but tremendously uplifting. And sometimes people see things you haven't even noticed yourself. And harmonising speech, you know, talking well about people who aren't present to other people. I mean, I've had tremendous experiences of that. You know, in the Sangha, I've met people who've been sort of spoken well of by other people. So when you meet them, you're sort of predisposed to feel positively about them. You know, it's the complete opposite of what can often happen. So these first two, dana, generosity and loving speech, makes it very, very clear that the Bodhisattva is a friendly person. Friendly to the particular people that he meets. He connects with. He uses beautiful, meaningful words and communication to draw the community together. But it's all of us doing that because, you know, we are all the Bodhisattva. I remember a lovely little moment on an order weekend. We used to have these order weekends in the dining room. That was a shrine room, and the whole order, or lots of order members, would come, and we'd all sit in a circle. And we'd all report in. It would take all weekend. And Banti would sit in a big armchair and listen to us all reporting in. And he'd just done a load of ordinations in Tuscany. And there was an order member very devoted to Banti. He got up and for his reporting in, he just rejoiced in Banti's merits. He said, "Banti, you've done it again. You've ordained all these people. It's so wonderful." And he said, "You're a Bodhisattva." And Banti said, "Well, we all are." It was a really wonderful moment. So the third Sangravastu, means of unification, is Artacharya, which can be translated as beneficial activity or meaningful activity, activity for the goal. And here, in the explanations of this in the tradition, the most meaningful activity is communicating the Dharma. And that is regarded as the greatest altruistic activity according to Buddhist tradition. It's the most important of all, to communicate the Dharma to others. So this doesn't necessarily mean giving lectures, formally teaching meditation, writing books. It could be more informal with that. You're just sitting talking. And the Dharma emerges in the communication because you're deeply in touch with it. You're living it. And by the Dharma, of course, we mean specifically the way to enlightenment. You might not mention that on your first meeting with somebody. They don't quite know that that's what they're getting into when they come to the class. But that's actually what you're about. That's what you're doing. You're a farer in the Dharma for enlightenment for all. So I say this, I'm emphasising the communication of the Dharma, because sometimes people think the altruistic dimension of going for refuge must mean feeding the starving, housing the homeless, alleviating sickness and disease, alleviating depression and mental illness, bringing about social justice and so on and so forth, all those things. Now, I'm not saying that those activities shouldn't be engaged in, but the priority is, and certainly the priority of the FWO should be, that those are expressions of the Dharma, and that we must beware that of getting involved in activities, however good they might be, that might detract and distract from the communication of the Dharma. So if we are involved in those other areas, it must be, they must be standing on the Dharma. So I was thinking about Dada Rinpoche in relation to this. We circumambulate his stupa, don't we, every night. Of course, he was trained in the Dharma, you know, given that tremendous training in the old Gelug system. He's a great teacher, a great bodhisattva. And he saw the homeless refugee children coming out of Tibet. So the thing to do was to respond to their need by housing them and giving them an education. And you can read accounts of people who he took off the streets of Kalimpong in that booklet, Dada Rinpoche's Celebration. You get a very strong sense of what he did for people. But for him, it's all on the basis of the Dharma. It's a response, a direct response, you know, to the suffering around him. But it's coming out of the Dharma. Dada Rinpoche used to do at least 5 hours a day of formal spiritual practice. And he ran his school. And he made sure that the Dharma values pervaded the education in his school. He resisted being subsumed to the West Bengal education system, you know, which would have destroyed the very particular approach that he was taking. And it's very interesting, when we started, when Lokamitra first went to the school, he was the first of Sangharakshita's disciples to go and see Dada Rinpoche. The school was in real trouble because it really didn't have the funds to keep going. And the West Bengal authorities said, okay, if you want money from us, you have to change the curriculum. It can't have the Dharma basis. And of course, you know, out of Lokamitra's connection and out of this community of Dharma practitioners in the West, we could raise money so that that school could keep going. So it's all, you know, come out of Dharma practitioners, keeping that unique project going. You know, or with Dr. Ambedkar in India, what Bhante has called the Dhamma Revolution. You know, Ambedkar saw very, very early on, Dr. Ambedkar saw very early on that really, if there was going to be a real revolution, a real social revolution in India, and not just political change, but a real social revolution, there needed to be a profound change of heart and consciousness. You know, if you were actually going to uproot caste and untouchability, you know, legislation was important, but in the end, it was consciousness that you had to change. And that's why he converted to Buddhism. That the Dharma would underpin, you know, any other changes that are going on. And it is actually happening. That is actually happening to people. And again, we do have social work projects in India, but where have they come from? Where has the funding come from that? It's come out of Dharma practitioners in the West. It's run by Dharma practitioners in the East. So again, these things have come out of very, very strong Dharma practice. And we mustn't forget that. And it's, you know, in the West, there's Sangharakshita's vision of, you know, and it's very unfashionable these days, but, you know, the new society or building the Buddha land and looking at new structures, ways of people coming together. So I've talked about, you know, the centre, but there's also communities, you know, like, you know, and retreat centres, we wouldn't have a Padmaloka without a men's community. It just wouldn't be Padmaloka without this stream of community. Team-based right livelihood, you know, that it's going through a lean phase at the moment, but so much has been made possible by the livelihood projects in the FWBA. Very easy to criticise these structures, very, very easy to do that. But what they have made possible, what they're still making possible, is something extraordinary. And they come from, they work best when the people involved with them are practicing the Dharma very, very seriously. Obviously, there's lots of other structures that we could develop. You know, we're at the very early days of building the Buddha land. And I know sometimes people feel that, there's not sort of enough engagement in social projects. Look, communicating the Dharma is engaged Buddhism. It's social work, if you really want to know. You know, actually teaching people meditation and how to really look at their mind and to come together in the ways I'm talking about is transformative. Yeah, loads of things will come out of that in the future. But that is engagement. And that is the real Dharma engagement. That's where you begin. If you try and do it on another basis, the whole thing's going to go skewed. You know, you transform consciousness. That brings about transformation of the structures, the way we are together. And that in turn is going to create stronger transformations of consciousness. So the upshot of this is train yourself to be able to communicate the Dharma, all of you here. In the early days of the FWBO, Sangharakshita said every order member, each and every order member, should have 3 Dharma talks that they're ready to give at a moment's notice. 3. They can give 3 talks. Don't have to be long talks, don't have to be slick talks, they just have to be clear, you know, and straightforward. 3 talks. 1 on the Buddha and Buddhism, 1 on meditation, and 1 on a Dharma subject of your choice. You know, so start working on preparing those talks now, because you don't know. You know, I just looked at Graham there, he lives in Littlehampton. You know, supposing the Brighton Buddhist Centre gets an invitation from the Littlehampton Women's Institute and an order member can't go. So they know that Graham's in Littlehampton, they phone you up and say, can you go and give a talk at the WI on Buddhism? And you say, yes, I've got the very talk ready to give. And you go along and give it. And when you're giving the Dharma discourse, the Dharma eye of Mrs. Smith of Littlehampton opens. And she goes for refuge there and then. Sorry, Graham. You know, but always be ready to accept an invitation. There's a Bodhisattva precept. Never refuse an invitation to speak on the Dharma. Brilliant. You know, what a fantastic injunction. You know, be ready to do that. And, you know, looking around this room, there's nobody who couldn't do that. Nobody here who couldn't do that. So be ready. You know, in the old days, Sangharakshita used to organise speakers' classes, even before people were ordained. And you'd have a gift to give a talk with him there, and then get critical feedback on the talk. Hardcore. So you know, learn the Dharma, you know, and you don't just need to be clear about the principles. You don't have to have a fantastic encyclopedic knowledge. You know the Dharma, be clear about it. You've got a feeling for it. It's changed your life. You know, get that in your mind so that you can benefit others. That's why we're doing all this, you know, so that we can benefit and tune into others so that they can enter the path. Fourthly, there's samanatata, which means exemplification, being an example. This doesn't mean, you'll be relieved to hear, being an example of Buddhahood or an example of stream entry or an absolutely sort of perfect saint or anything like that. I'm sure you realise that from observing order members. Myself included. But what you're an example of is the committed life. Yeah, that's what you're an example of. You're an example of going for refuge for the benefit of all, with all its struggles and all its striving. That's what you exemplify. You know, and above all, you connect. Above all, you connect with others. You're an example of connecting on the basis of the Dharma. And you don't have to think of yourself as a teacher. You know, you don't need to think about being a teacher. This is much, much better word, traditional word, for what we're really about. Dharma Dhuta. Dharma Dhuta. Dhuta means messenger. Messenger of the Dharma. That's so much more expressive. You know, you're trying to connect people with the Dharma. Not with you. I mean, they will connect with you. But what you're concerned is to link them up with something much bigger. The Dharma and the Sangha and the Buddha. That's what you're concerned to do. A few years ago, I had a sort of crisis because, I love communicating the Dharma. But the crisis I had was that I felt I was incredibly superficial in my Buddhist practice. And, you know, I remember there was a particular order member who every time I saw him, you know, a good friend of mine, was always going on about depth, 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 depth. And I thought, Jesus, you know, I'm not particularly deep. Anyway, and I had this sort of crisis, and I thought I ought to just stop, you know, communicating the Dharma or doing talks, leading study groups, because, you know, I wasn't communicating from the profound depths of spiritual insight. So I went to see Bhante about it, you know, and it was a real crisis. And he said, well, you know, yes, it would be better if you had more depth. But, you know, people probably wouldn't know you had it anyway. I mean, you know, that might inform your Dharma communication. But, you know, it's not as if you're going to tell them you've got that depth or anything like that. He said, think of yourself more as a sort of medium for the Dharma. That's the way I think of myself. You're just connecting people with the Dharma. And of course, it reminded me of something he said. And he really meant this. This is no false modesty when he said, I know very well that I was not the best person to start a new Buddhist movement. You know, when I look at my limitations and, you know, the real qualities that are needed, I was not the best person. You know, and then he said, sometimes I'm dimly aware of a vast overshadowing consciousness that has through me started the Western Buddhist order. So he sort of started it in spite of himself. There was something to be done, and he was there. So we might not be the best, but who cares? Who wants the best? You're just there, and there's a job to be done to connect people with the Dharma, connecting others with the three jewels so that they can grow and flourish and mature and ripen. So above all, befriend others. Share yourself, share your life. Share the riches of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha with others. Aspire to be a Kalyana Mitra, which means, of course, a lovely friend, a good friend, an auspicious friend, a spiritual friend. Reflect, well, you know, all the members have befriended me. They've gone out to me. People have, you know, got when I went along to the centre and feeling a bit unsure of myself, people went out and they put their hand out to me. And people have taken an interest in me. Well, I can do that for others. I can, you know, so that you know they can connect. I've received a lot actually. A lot of effort's gone into the transmission of the Dharma. So why don't I do the same? Why don't I be part of that and hand it on? This is the expression of the altruistic dimension, and it's great fun. Being involved in this project. It's so much. It's such a laugh. I mean, it really is. Even when it's really difficult. I mean, it really should have that aspect of the spontaneous, compassionate activity. It should be play. Enjoy it, even when it's difficult. I remember an order member telling me, we were chatting about a centre he'd visited, he was a president of. I'm not going to tell you where the centre is. And, you know, not many people were coming along to the centre and not many people were sort of sticking at the centre. And I said, why not? He said, well, he said, when you see how miserable the order members are running it, you know, it's no surprise that nobody sticks. You know, who's going to want to be part of that, you know, when people are seeing it as a sort of chore? And he's right, you know. I mean, if it's all sort of, you know, oh, you know, look at me, I'm doing all these classes and making heavy weather of it, who's going to stick? Who's going to want to be part of that? Well, no one, unless they're masochists. You know, for me and for many I know, it's the most wonderful thing, you know, being involved in communicating the Dharma. You know, seeing somebody growing and maturing, seeing that spiritual potential wake up, is a most incredible thing. One of the most beautiful sights you could know, known to man. You know, it's we know how lovely springtime is, but when you see that happening in somebody, it's breathtaking sometimes when you see their courage, their effort, their expansion, their understanding growing. It's tremendously moving, and seeing the way they change. And it inspires, when I see it, inspires me to make more effort to go deeper into the Dharma. You know, this is why, you know, people say sometimes, why have you been so long at Padmaloka? I sort of need to be. You know, I need to kind of be involved in an environment where I'm actually talking about what it means to be an order member and sharing that life. Because basically I'm a bit spiritually thick, you know, because I don't get it. You know, so going over it, there's a chance that it will sort of stick. No, I mean that. I really do mean that. And, you know, Dharma Rinpoche, when he was being installed as a talku, you know, he was an incarnation of a great lama who was very close. The previous Dalai Rinpoche was very close to the great 13th Dalai Lama. He was very highly thought of in the Geluk hierarchy. So when, as a young boy, the previous Dalai Rinpoche was, Limpante's teacher, was being sort of enthroned at his great monastic college, all these people were around him. And he thought, these people regard me as a bodhisattva, but I'm not a bodhisattva. But because they want me to be a bodhisattva, I will make every effort to be a bodhisattva. I find that just incredibly moving, you know, to hear that. You know, knowing that he's not that, but people see him like that, so he makes every effort to become that. You know, we become what others need. I think often order members can lose their way because they're not helping others less experienced, because they're not involved in the transmission of the Dharma enough. So they don't go over sufficiently what is basic. They don't develop the qualities which they need in order to develop spiritually. So what comes out of this? Going for refuge brings you closer to others. In fact, going for refuge, you know, brings you, you know, closer to the whole of life, all life whatsoever. This is Sangharakshita's vision of going for refuge, his profound vision of the cosmic going for refuge. So I'm going to end with Sangharakshita. It seems the right place to end. I'm going to end with his description of the cosmic going for refuge in his original lecture when he talked about this. So this is where going for refuge leads. This is the insight that it leads to. So this is Sangharakshita. If one looks at the evolutionary process, what one does see, what does one see? One sees a going for refuge because each form of life aspires to develop into the higher form. It goes for refuge, as it were. Now this may sound impossibly poetic, but this is in fact what one sees. In man, the evolutionary process becomes conscious of itself. That's effective going for refuge. Through effective going for refuge, we're united with all living beings who also, in their own way, in their own degree, on their own level, in a sense, go for refuge. All living beings go for refuge. The flower goes for refuge. The trees go for refuge. The bird goes for refuge. I don't want to sentimentalise. I feel we're perilously near that, perhaps. So let's stop there and just say the cosmos goes for refuge. So So going for refuge is not simply a particular devotional practice. It's not even an act of individual spiritual commitment. The going for refuge is the key to the mystery of existence itself.